Good afternoon. This is Bruce Freed at Dentons. Welcome to the second in a series of conversations we're having with friends and clients to discuss the status of America's Health Care Act, the so-called repeal and replace legislation currently about to be considered on the floor of the House of Representatives tomorrow. With me today are my colleagues, Jennifer Healy, a counsel in Denton's Public Policy Group, and John Russell, a principal in Denton's Public Policy Group. Just quickly by way of background, John was Deputy Chief of Staff to two speakers, Republican speakers in the House, and is involved in counseling an array of healthcare organizations with regard to federal government relations. Similarly, Jennifer, Jen, to her friends, was for 10 years a senior health policy advisor both in the House and in the Senate, and enjoys exceptional relations with some of the most important healthcare staff in both the Senate and the House. And again, this is Bruce Freed. I'm a partner in the healthcare group and delighted to welcome all of you to this call. Why don't I turn the microphone over to Jen and John, and they'll take it from here.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you. We're starting off with today being the day before the vote scheduled in the House floor. So before a bill can come to the House floor, it has to go through the House Rules Committee, and that is currently meeting up on Capitol Hill right now. And the Rules Committee on the House is the way that the House determines and controls the debate when the bills come to the floor of the House. And so it is a committee that is, whoever the majority party is controlled by leadership. The votes are the votes are stacked in such a way that leadership controls sort of what happens out of there. So while the Rules Committee will last a very long time today, the conclusion and the outcome of the Rules Committee has been predetermined ahead of time. They started this morning at 10 a.m. and they started with a panel for testifying basically of what is in the bill and the that is before the Rules Committee that will be considered on the floor of the House tomorrow. And that starts with a panel of those testifying of the committees of jurisdiction. So currently it's the Budget Committee, the Ways and Means Committee, and the Energy and Commerce Committee that have been testifying since 10 a.m. this morning on the details of the Republican health care plan, the American Health Care Act. They haven't yet gotten to the part where members will be offering their individual amendments. There have been 29 amendments that have been filed before the Rules Committee, 4 Democrat amendments, 1 bipartisan amendment, and 24 Republican amendments. 3 of those amendments are what's called a manager's amendment. So those are the amendments that include all the last-minute deal-making that leadership has been making to try to get themselves to the magic number of the majority of votes for the House. The House passes bills by a majority of members that are present and voting. There's a few vacancies in the House right now per members of the House that have now been picked up by the administration. So they're looking for the magic number 216, and that is what they will be looking for tomorrow. The X factors on the politics currently playing into this, and then we'll get into the policy, is that the outside conservative outside groups, Club for Growth and Heritage Foundation, after the manager's amendment had been posted, have reiterated their opposition for the bill, putting some of the conservative House members in a difficult position between the White House and those outside groups. And that will be playing into the magic of the leadership on the House floor. So I'll go over what was sort of in the manager's amendment, what were some of those changes made as they're trying to get to 216, and then my colleague John will talk about the politics of a tough vote on the House floor since he lived a few of those in his days up on Capitol Hill. Basically, the manager's amendment that was outlined and made it publicly available late on Monday night made a couple of changes to try to accommodate some of these far-right conservative members of the House Freedom Caucus. They made some concessions for those folks on the Medicaid side. So as you recall from the last webinar that we did, the Medicaid enrollment expansion versus non-expansion debate and conversation, the bill that was rolled out made the determination that Medicaid expansion enrollment would be frozen in the year of 2020, and that any state that had expanded those populations that were enrolled on December 31st, 2019 would maintain to be given that enhanced Medicaid matching rate, which was one of the main priorities for expansion state governors, is that they would continue to receive that enhanced federal matching rate for as long as they could. And so the deal that came out and was before the House Committee's Energy and Commerce was that if you had expansion populations enrolled on December 31st, 2019, those individuals would maintain that enhanced matching rate for as long as they stayed in the program. So as long as there wasn't any break for more than 30 days, the states could count on getting that enhanced matching rate. What came out in the manager's amendment were some concessions to the conservative groups. One that were one concern they addressed were for the conservative side of things is that some non-expansion states could decide to expand between now and 2020 to take advantage of the fact that they now knew that the enhanced federal matching rate would last. And so in the manager's amendment, they made a change that said that if states had expanded as of March 1st, 2017, the enrollment would be frozen. So that precluded any states in the future from expanding. They also included a work requirement for non-disabled, non-elderly, non-pregnant adults beginning in fiscal year 2018. That was also a concession given to the conservative members of the House to add a work requirement in Medicaid. This goes along with sort of the letter that CMS Administrator Seema Verma and Secretary Tom Price sent last week that basically sort of outlining their view of what a Medicaid program should be and where they would be taking it in the future, which is more about moving people out of Medicaid and into employment and into an insurance policy as opposed to sort of a constant state of enrollment in Medicaid. They preserved in the manager's amendment that states can continue to add to that expansion population past those deadlines. They would just be at the regular matching rate, so states would be allowed to continue to add populations outside of those targeted Medicaid enrollment populations. It would just be at the regular federal matching rate. The other change they made for the conservative members of the House were to give states the options to choose Medicaid block grants and not just only the per capita allotment. This is actually something that some individual states had expressed interest, that they would like to choose a block grant over a per capita allotment. States apparently like Georgia and North Dakota had have expressed that block grants they feel like would work better for them. So this was something that leadership could give to the conservatives as well as maintaining the ability for states to choose what they think is best for them. Another change they made in the manager's amendment was they increased the annual inflation factor for the elderly and disabled populations within Medicaid to CPIU Medical Plus One. It also, the manager's amendment clarifies that the per capita allotment growth rate does compound year to year. It also included a $1 billion fund to help with implementation over in the agencies. Implementation of the Medicaid per capita allotment, that patient and state stability fund that we discussed in the last webinar, which was a pot of money, $100 billion over 10 years for states to access to stabilize their individual insurance market, whether that would mean creating risk pools for their state citizens or incentives to cover cost-sharing the cost-sharing aspects of healthcare, or to help create new competition within their insurance market. That patient and state stability fund is a fund of money that states can apply to have access to make changes to innovate within their state insurance market, individual insurance market. There also was an addition in the manager's amendment that is a New York-specific Medicaid change that Representatives Chris Collins and Mr. Faso are taking credit for getting, which is a very specific New York Medicaid issue where counties and the state contribute to the cost of their Medicaid program, and that the change in the manager's amendment would shift that cost from the county back to the state. The Republican members are claiming that this will help bring some property relief to local counties outside of New York City. The governor of New York is crying foul, as it would create, as he says, over a $3 billion hole in his state budget. The other major change in the manager's amendment was it moved the repeal of the ACA taxes 1 year earlier, so back to 2017 retroactive and not till 2018 as the bill was before the House committees. And this is mainly not necessarily for that substantive change that the taxes would actually, when the ink dries and the bill signed into law, have that year earlier. What they're trying to do is to create a bit of a fund, if you will, for when the Senate takes up the bill next week, to have some wiggle room on the revenue thresholds that will be governed by the Senate budget rules. So they're trying to give themselves a little bit of wiggle room, or basically a slush fund, if you will, for the Senate to be able to work with on the amendments on the Senate floor to deal with one of the main continued sort of concerns for Republicans on the House and the Senate side is whether or not the amounts of the refundable tax credits in the House replacement bill are sufficient to provide a meaningful amount of money to individuals to buy health insurance on the individual market. So in order to not run afoul of Senate budget rules and make amendments susceptible to a budget point of order, which would take away the simple majority privilege that the reconciliation bill has, they are trying to create a little bit more wiggle room for themselves where they could do some amendments on the Senate floor with maybe increasing the amount of these refundable tax credits and not be susceptible to a budget point of order, because they can take that money from sort of this change in the date of repealing the ACA taxes. So that is the contours of the main highlights of the manager's amendment as sort of the policy changes that leadership had made up until Monday night in trying to get to that magic number of 216. And so now I'll turn it over to John to talk about what is it like on the House floor trying to get to a magic number where, as press reports are to be believed, Freedom Caucus is saying they still have 25 no votes. They seem to be a little bit away from 216.
And it's interesting to say, thank you, John. It's interesting to say 216, as 218 was beat into our heads and all you had to do was count to 218. So now getting to 216 seems eminently easier. However, as we all know, certainly with all tough votes, all hard votes, that's very hard to get to. I think there are a couple of things you have to remember when you're going into, once you've cleared Rules Committee and you're going into a vote, and when you're thinking and listening to members and reading press accounts of their reactions to the legislation. Members of Congress seemingly always want more time. They always want to keep working on legislation. The question is always, why are we doing this now? Well, in this case, the answer seems to be, we're doing this now to clear the decks because we've got tax reform, we've got infrastructure, we've got Dodd-Frank reform, we have a whole agenda to move. This is just one piece of it. The second thing that's always important is there are very few inflection points in a congressional calendar that allow you as a congressman to get something. And that something in this case, now that earmarks are gone, I should readily admit I had the ability, we had earmarks when I was doing this years ago. That said, this is still an opportunity for members to extract something from leadership. This is generally why you whip as an undecided. This is why you whip as a lean no. In some cases, this is why you whip as a lean yes. I'll tell you, we've been hearing from members on the Hill and their staff that Steve Scalise and his whip team are, in fact, not focusing on those lean yeses at the moment. They've counted them. They are focusing solely on the lean nos and nos. Finally, I think you've got to remember that if whether it's 218 or 216, you're always, where we were always 10 to 12 votes short going to the House floor. There were always enough undecideds in some cases, and a certain Medicare Modernization Act vote, that these were fully decided and leaning and no's, you were far away from the magic number. That's because, as most people understand, getting under those hot lights of the House floor, things can change. Arms can be twisted. In fact, generally off camera and in the cloakroom, sometimes arms can be broken. Members are treading lightly here because, in fact, there's been a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B, if you will, included in this manager's amendment, meaning they've tried to thread that tight needle by giving something to both the moderates as well as giving something to the conservatives. Generally, when you do that, nobody's happy. I would argue that if you look back at some of the larger pieces of legislation that were, in fact, both in Republican Congresses and Democratic Congresses, things pass when nobody's happy. There is also the other body, and as a House staffer, it pains me to say, but the other body does matter significantly here. And there is an argument, and leadership is certainly using it, that we need to push this ball as far as we can because this is not going to be what the final deal is. Couple things that I'm looking for over the next, honestly, 4 or 5 hours. I've noticed that since about 10 o'clock, or I should say about 11 o'clock today, if you were watching any of the cable news channels, Paul Ryan's doing stand-up interviews in the Capitol Rotunda. He is not sequestered in his office having member after member come in. That matters. I'm also watching very carefully, and as I say this, checking my phone to make sure it hasn't been called, but is there an emergency conference for Republican members slated within the next hour or two? We continue to hear that that is not the case, though they have kept a certain room or two available and held it for the full day, but in fact no announcement has in fact gone out saying that there is going to be a conference. And finally, you know, the question is, do you pull the bill? Now that is a decision made by about three people in a room. And those three people at the moment are in different ends of the Capitol. Some are actually off the Hill doing a public speaking engagement at the moment and are not together. It's looking back on some of the things that have passed the House, you generally saw leadership working very, very closely together, working almost in you can't say tandem with three, so I'll let you figure out what the proper verbiage is, but taking members from one office to the next, trying to get them to yes, trying to get them to, in some cases, off no and to undecided. I think you have to finally think about one other thing. Members of Congress are, in fact, human, believe it or not. Yes, some do argue they get an extra chromosome the day they're elected, but they are human, and there is fatigue. And leadership knows that, and leadership uses that. Certainly, good whips and good whip teams use that. Members for this vote, which will not be 15 minutes plus 3 minutes of a walking around time, this one's going to go for a while. And when it goes for a while, members can, in fact, get beaten down. The pressure becomes almost inhuman and outerworldly. And to be a staffer up against the wall or working in the halls, working in the chamber itself, you truly can feel the pressure get ratcheted up every minute. This time around, Republicans are very clear that they will not enjoy any Democratic support for this legislation whatsoever. This is all on their backs. And I think you're going to find a lot of them want to get this done, knowing that this is not the final product, want to move it to the Senate, and want to start talking about other things.
Absolutely. And I let me know if you agree or disagree, but I think that a lot of the announcements today, the Freedom Caucus announcement today, this idea that they're really far, you know, quote unquote, very far away from having the votes they need, is a lot of their last chance of stopping the bill from coming to the floor.
Yes.
Because I think if they know the bill comes to the floor, especially for Freedom Caucus members, it's very hard for them to actually cast a no vote on a bill that repeals parts of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, and to cast no vote against their president.
Right.
It might be easier for members of the Freedom Caucus to say they're casting a no vote against their speaker. But Donald Trump has linked his arms with Speaker Ryan around this, and they're jumping off the cliff together. They have drawn a direct line to them and this legislation. And that's a harder thing for most of these members to do. It's also interesting, A lot of these guys, men and women, have never been in Congress with a Republican president. And the power of the presidency, what's available to them, how the presidency can be used to help them, is certainly a topic of conversation for some of these vulnerable members.
Absolutely. And while some of the folks that are joining us might be and most likely are out of Washington, D.C., and obviously there's a lot going around about President Trump's presidency right now, and so you might wonder, well, how does this guy have any cachet to convince anybody to vote on anything? And I think the reality is that for a lot of these members, especially the Freedom Caucus members, they have very loyal Trump supporters still in their districts. And so there is still a political calculation for them that is linked to President Trump, as well as the fact that it's still early in his presidency. And while there seems to be a lot of things clouding around the presidency at the moment, no one knows if those are going to stay long term or short term. And if they weather them and it becomes short term and you weren't with the president on one of his first big asks he has of you, that is that's very long repercussions for any president. It's, one could argue, especially for a president like this one who seems to have a very long memory when it comes
you
to grudges.
Yes. And
Let's look down the road just a little bit with different scenarios. John, let me start with you. Votes tomorrow, the vote fails. Then what? What are the procedural steps? What are the political machinations?
Yeah, I think that the
failed vote.
The reality is it's the political machinations that are significantly more important than the procedurals. If I remember correctly, the bill can be brought up the next day, or it can be brought up the next hour. It can be brought up in its form. If it changes,
we'll be able to see from when the Rules Committee actually reports out the rule,
yeah.
They will have things in there that will be indications of whether or not they want to keep that flexibility of whether or not it's something that they will bring up on Friday or bring up the next week.
So I think what I hear you saying is, should the stars not be in alignment tomorrow, should the whips not have done their job adequately, the bill fails on the first vote, where it's almost certain that we'll see a revision of the bill sufficient to address concerns and arms twisted and broken as necessary. And I think what I hear you saying is, if not tomorrow, the next
on Tuesday,
very quickly thereafter,
I think so.
The bill passes the House.
Yes.
Okay. Then, Jen, given your provenance from the Senate, the bill arrives in the Senate. It is a bill that, in the form or something similar to what we're seeing now, I think most observers believe it could not pass the Senate, assuming 100% of Democrats would vote no, and some good number, three, four, a sufficient number to kill the bill of Republicans would also vote no. What might we expect the process there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a couple of tea leaves to read. One, this change in the manager's amendment that provided this sort of slush fund for them to do actual substantive amendments on the Senate floor while staying in sort of within the boundaries of the Senate budget rules shows that they expect that they are going to have to make changes over there to get to their votes. I think you're going to see sort of the same dynamic being played on the House side, playing over the Senate side. Major concerns over affordability, major concerns over whether or not the tax credits are sufficient. Most likely, I think you can guess, is that they're going to plus up the tax credits for lower income Americans as well as older Americans and try to show that the tax credits will be meaningful amount of money to buy something on the individual market. You're also going to see that Medicaid conversation play out in the Senate, too. The senators that represent expansion states, do they think they've gotten enough? The senators that represent the non-expansion states, do they think there's enough in that bill? I think one of the big questions coming out of the manager's amendment change of not allowing those states to expand for the next couple of years, there is going to have to be something, I think, on the Senate side to those non-expansion state senators who feel like the states that, you know, should have did what Republicans asked, quote-unquote, asked them to do by not expanding Medicaid are now not getting rewarded for doing that. And I feel like there's definitely frustration by, you know, the Floridas, the Texas, the Kansas, of the Georgias of the world, and then there's going to have to be some sort of consideration for that. You're right, there are some conservative senators, much like the House Freedom Caucus, that have said, you know, unequivocally they are no. Rand Paul, Tom Cotton, Mike Lee. I think that, again, as we were talking about the House Freedom Caucus, some of that is they're trying to prevent the bill from coming to the floor, because I think they do know that once the bill's on the floor, that's a very tough no vote for them to cast. You also have the Senator Collins, you know, has concerns of the Planned Parenthood defunding in the House bill. I think most folks expect that that will be taken out within the Senate budget rules process, or if just the amendment making, you know, making it possible for Senator Collins to vote yes. Senator Portman is in a tough bind that Governor Kasich is sort of in the no way and heck is he going to support what the House is doing. And so Portman is in a position where he has to find some change, some addition that he can make on the Senate side to justify why he's going to get to yes. But he's generally a good leadership, you know, understands he's the reason of, like, politics is a team sport sometimes, and you have to vote yes, as John had said, so they can move on to get to something else. Sean Spicer has said in his press conference just this afternoon, you know, there is no plan B on health care. I think that just shows sort of what John was talking about, is that they aren't looking for to sort of capitulate to these, like, conservatives are saying, start over, this wasn't a good project, let's, you know, slow down and start over. That's not really in their vocabulary right now. So I think what you'll see, as John was saying, is a very long vote in the House tomorrow, a seemingly long weekend over the Senate twisting arms, because if it can't get off the House floor tomorrow, even with a very long vote, there's a loss of momentum there that is sort of is a huge sort of killer of an eventual success. So they kind of have to create their own momentum to have that carry over the Senate. So the changes that are made in the Senate, the House will be ping-ponged back to the House.
Well, that was
my question. Yeah.
We're increasingly in the land of speculation, which is always dangerous, but you two are two of the most astute observers of healthcare policy and politics in Washington. Given what we might expect to come out of the House, given that will then have to be further modified in the Senate to address concerns of some of these pivotal senators, that bill then, being different from what has passed the House, will necessarily have to go back to the House for another vote.
Yes.
Will the deal to get it out of the Senate move away from the House bill that was passed to the degree that it becomes a further challenge for the House to take it up and pass it again?
I think the whip count in the House the second time is going to be as difficult as the whip count in the House the first time. But I think the big sort of, I forget if this is a pun or not, but terrible pun, the trump card that leadership will have that second time in the House is, like, you literally are the last step before it gets to the president's desk. And that's why you hear them emphasizing this argument that we have campaigned on the promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Here is our chance to do it. And in that case, you'll have the House being the very last step. And so conservatives, yes, it might have gotten watered down in the Senate. That's what happens in the Senate. But now the decision before you is, do you want to repeal Obamacare or not? And that is a political vote that I don't think many in the Freedom Caucus can withstand.
Jenny, I think you're absolutely right. And as much as it pains a former House staffer to say it, yeah, you generally have to take what the Senate sends, hold your nose in some cases, but send it to the president's desk.
Well, the next few days are going to be incredibly interesting, starting with tomorrow. Any closing thoughts or comments before we sign off?
The only thing I would sort of say is generally on some of these changes in the healthcare program and what it means for the different industries that might be joining us on the call today is that the Medicaid changes the concerns that are pushing some of these Republican members to make changes is if the expansion population doesn't have a choice for Medicaid anymore, what will their choice be for health insurance? For providers, obviously, that's a huge question mark. If people under Medicaid turn into uninsured, they're back in the days of writing off care or having bad debt. And that's not a Republican goal either, but they need to answer that question. And that has a huge ramification from every different kind of provider in the healthcare system, from hospitals to skilled nursing facilities. Also, the budget squeeze that comes with the per capita allotment, which the Republicans, you know, are trying to create some cost controls of Medicaid as Medicaid continues to squeeze out state governors' budgets. Those budget squeezes can increase the pressure on efficiencies, which might increase the use of Medicaid managed care. In the tax credit world, the idea that these tax credits, whatever they end up being and however much they end up being, they are going to be allowed to be used in more pooling opportunities than currently in Obamacare, which is that one sort of federal exchange marketplace. So what kind of innovations can be made within the private sector to take advantage of the fact that private exchanges are going to be attractive again because tax credits are going to be allowed to be used in those? So I think so some of those questions are probably what's sort of facing industries as we see what these policy changes mean.
And I think, of course, then the focus has to change to HHS and watch and see what the secretary will be doing, because that is clearly a leg of the stool that of repealing and replacing the ACA. And, you know, Republicans have talked about a follow-on bill that would address some broader concerns. I remind everyone that, that broader bill can't really be run through a reconciliation process, and that's 60. And how are you going to get those 60 votes in the Senate? How are you going to get those Democrats on this follow-on bill?
Once again, you two bring a level of insight, sophistication, and wonkishness that I've not heard from other commenters and observers of this challenging process. So thank you. For those who have been listening on the phone, thank you for joining us. We will be looking forward to scheduling another of these webinars. We have heard from many of you that you have found them to be incredibly insightful, and that's why we're doing it. So please look for another invitation on Monday, where we'll try to read some of the tea leaves that will have settled to the bottom at that point. Thanks again. Have a great weekend. Until